This podcast sponsored by Cherry Hill Volvo.
At Cherry Hill Volvo, we have absolutely incredible offers, and a plethora of both new and certified Volvos from which to choose. Join Cherry Hill Volvo for the pricing and attention you deserve. I am Judith Krupnik, president of Cherry Hill Volvo.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
WOGL HD3, Philadelphia, from the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. The revolution will be broadcast.
This is the next generation of talk. Now, on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT, Rich Zeoli.
A major win for freedom at the United States Supreme Court today. Two big wins for the Constitution and a big slap in the face to government. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here today. 855-839-1210 on Twitter at Rich Zeoli. The debt fight intensifies. Governor Ron DeSantis' reaction to his announcement yesterday. It's all here for you on a jam-packed 3 hours to go. But very happy to welcome to the show Thomas Berry. Thomas Berry is a research fellow at the Cato Institute's Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. And it's great to have you here, Thomas Berry. I know you used to be at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Big win for them today, for your former organization.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Two big wins in one day, in fact, for an organization with only about 30 lawyers. I don't know of many other organizations that have that claim to fame of two Supreme Court wins in one day.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. I'm a huge fan of not only the Cato Institute, which I am, but also the Pacific Legal Foundation. So it's great to have you on the show, since you represent both organizations in one time or another. Let's start with the WOTUS ruling, shall we? I mean, the waters of the United States. What I'm seeing here is it's giving me a lot of hope that the way this court has responded to the EPA twice now, by pushing back against their egregious overreach, that when ultimately they do rule on Chevron, we might see the end to this deference to the out-of-control executive branch of government.
Yeah, I think that may well be an apt inference from the way the court has been ruling lately. And this is certainly a very welcome end to what's been an unbelievably long legal saga. Believe it or not, this case went up to the Supreme Court all the way back in 2008 on a preliminary question of just how it could be litigated. So this family has been fighting for the ability to build on their property for over 15 years.
Amazing. And 15 years now, we're dealing with, what was it, something like 0.63 acres of land or something. And the real idea of this WOTUS rule, this Waters of the United States, give us an overview of what the government's argument here, what the EPA's argument in terms of their ability to regulate, and to what extent, how far the reach went up until this ruling.
Sure. So this all comes from the Clean Water Act, which basically says you need a permit to dump or otherwise affect waters of the United States. And so the crux of the issue is, what does that term mean? What's a water of the United States? The government has consistently tried to define that as expansively as it can. At one point, it said it's literally anything wet that a migratory bird might take a stop in. So if there's a puddle that a bird takes a little nap in on its way to the Gulf of Mexico, that counts. Later, that got struck down by the Supreme Court. Yeah, that got down by the Supreme Court. But their current approach is they basically wanted to do what they call the significant nexus test, which is, say there's a lake and you have a bit of wetland in your backyard. It's not at all connected to the lake, but say that it's part of one ecosystem. So maybe some frogs, you know, will migrate and spend some time in your backyard and later spend some time in the lake. Maybe, you know, storms are affected by both, whatever. Basically, anytime you can show some connections in nature between your water and a permanent water, that's enough. So that was the government's argument, and that's why they claimed that this kind of marshy, wet area in the backyard of this couple's property, that's why they claimed it was a wetland and the water of the U.S.
It's amazing the overreach of private property rights that the EPA was trying to do here. It's amazing but not surprising. I mean, obviously, they view private property rights as something that is subject to a bureaucrat deciding whether or not you really own it, not something that is enshrined in this nation's founding. And that's the difference, obviously, and that's why it's great to have Cato and the Pacific Legal Foundation fighting for property rights again, but also fighting against the administrative state. I think this case means so much as a win because both issues were there, right? Private property rights and also the overreach of the administrative state. That's why this ruling is making a lot of people happy. Now, explain to us, if you could, Thomas Berry. It was a unanimous decision. However, there were several concurring decisions that were 5-4. So what does that all mean? The Washington Post never mentioned it was a unanimous decision. In fact, Chuck Schumer's out there whining that it's the MAGA Supreme Court that overturned this rule.
That's right. So it was unanimous on the judgment. Everyone agreed that the Sackett's own property, the actual property at issue in this case, is not a water of the United States. So on the judgment, on the upshot, it was unanimous. But on the rule to apply going forward, it was sharply split 5-4. So the majority opinion by Justice Alito, in my view, correctly established a bright line rule that essentially said waters of the United States are permanent bodies of water, the kind of things that are obviously water, like a lake, a river, a stream, plus wetlands that are contiguous with those. So no break in between, no, 30-yard gap that maybe they're only connected by an ecosystem. No, the opinion says there has to literally be a fully connected, contiguous, sheet of water connecting your wetland to the permanent body, the lake or the stream. And in that case, it can be regulated. And so that test, the good thing about that test, in my view, is that it's easier for people to see with their own eyes. You don't have to hire really expensive ecologists to tell you whether or not your backyard puddle is a water of the United States. Concurrences, so four justices that concurred in the judgment, they wanted a test closer to the government's. So this was the three more liberal justices, plus somewhat surprisingly, Justice Kavanaugh as well, joining those three. And they would have had a somewhat more expansive rule that applied to wetlands, not just wetlands connected to rivers and streams, but pretty much anything that can be described as a wetland, even not connected to a more permanent body of water.
Interesting. So the good news is that not only did the property owners win, but also going forward, we have this new way of looking at this rule that I think is going to make a lot more sense and it will really restrain the Environmental Protection Agency.
Absolutely. And one key point that Alito's opinion made is that there can be criminal penalties for violating the Clean Water Act. And it's a core crux of American jurisprudence that you have to have bright line rules when you have criminal penalties. People should be able to tell whether conduct is a crime or not. So it's especially serious to have really vague, unpredictable rules when there are not just civil but potentially criminal penalties at stake.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm so glad you're here with us today. Thomas Berry is a research fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Before joining Cato, he was an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is the firm today, or organization, I guess I'd really say, that had two wins before the United States Supreme Court. Truly, truly amazing. Now, turning over to this, to the asset forfeiture case or the seizure case, the home equity theft case. I mean, here you have a woman who owed the government some property taxes. They slapped on a whole bunch of fees and a whole bunch of interest, and then ultimately took her house, sold her house, and kept the excess proceeds. Is that pretty much a good breakdown of what happened?
That's exactly it. It's a pretty outrageous fact. She owed about, $15,000 in taxes and fees. They sold her house for $40,000, and they pocketed the excess. So essentially, they pocketed $25,000 that was her own home equity.
So the Pacific Legal Foundation represented her. It took 10 years. This woman's in her 90s. She's a great-grandmother. It's a heartbreaking story. The lower court, what's interesting to me is that the lower court was unanimous in their ruling, saying that the government absolutely had a right to take that equity. And today's Supreme Court ruling was unanimous, saying that they don't.
Absolutely. The lower courts had essentially bought Minnesota's argument that we get to define property however we want. We can pass our own laws that say what's your property and what's not. So they essentially bought the Minnesota argument that because we have a statute that says, oh, it's not your property anymore once you haven't paid your taxes and once you seize it, then there's no taking because you can't have a taking if it's not your property. But the Supreme Court quite rightly said, well, if it's that easy to get away from the requirement to pay just compensation, then any state can get around that requirement. They can just say, oh, it's not taking. We're just redefining it as not your property anymore.
There's a lot of states around the country that do this, right? That they will, first of all, I mean, everybody adds the fees and the interest, and in these seemingly minor property tax bills become something that would just crush a person. That alone, I think, needs to be looked at some point. But beyond that, I mean, once these bills add up and then the states come in and seize property, I was reading a little bit from the Pacific Legal Foundation about what some states do. I mean, some of them are just downright egregious with having basically selling the tax liability to an outside company who then buys it and then winds up kicking the people out of their home. And sometimes the homeowners don't even know that the tax debt has been sold. There's some things out there that just really make you cringe.
Absolutely. And according to Pacific Legal Foundation, there are 13 states that have this practice like Minnesota, what they call, I think correctly, home equity theft. And the great thing about this decision is that it's so thoroughly struck down what Minnesota is doing that it sets a clear precedent that none of these other states can continue doing this as well. So if any other state besides Minnesota tries to do something similar going forward, this precedent is a clear message to lower courts that they just can't allow this to go on anymore.
Are you surprised it was a unanimous ruling? Were there any concurring opinions or anything like that?
There was one concurring opinion, a good one by Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Jackson, that pointed out not only did this violate the takings clause, it also violated the excessive fines clause. That's another part of the Constitution that says you can't have a fine that exceeds, that's unreasonable, that's excessive. And essentially, if you treat the $25,000 as a fine, it was obviously excessive compared to the $15,000 that she owed. So he essentially completely agreed with the majority opinion and said, this is not only unconstitutional, it's twice over unconstitutional.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And I agree with that 100%. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, Thomas Berry, is that when you've got a property tax bill of a couple hundred bucks or a couple thousand dollars, and then with the penalties, the fees and the interest and the compounding interest and everything else, it becomes just something that a lot of people just can't pay. And I think that does need to be looked into here. So I'm glad Justice Gorsuch wrote that opinion. And I'm happy to hear that Justice Jackson joined in on that, because it's outrageous what government can do if you owe them money.
Absolutely. And a lot of the times it's not based on, it's not based on what's fair in terms of what they owed. It's based on what does the county need. And the county was, shameless. They conceded that the reason they take this money is that they use it for their own ends. They want to build, libraries and firehouses and whatever. And so when a fine is essentially for the purpose of paying city needs, rather than actually, pegged for what people should rightly owe, that's a serious problem.
Before I let you go, where do things stand with civil asset forfeiture? I know that that's something that Cato has spoken out against a lot, and I know the Pacific Legal Foundation has spoken out against it as well. I find it to be one of the most egregious violations of the Constitution, civil forfeiture. Do you think that at some point the high court is going to tackle this issue?
I do think it will eventually. This is something that Pacific Legal Foundation has been doing a great job bringing a lot of cases. They've had a lot of victories in the lower courts. They still have not been able to get a case up to the Supreme Court to set a precedent nationwide. But I certainly think that both of these decisions today show that this current Supreme Court is very favorably inclined to private property rights. And you can make exactly the same excessive fines argument about this. Another organization called Institute for Justice, where I once interned, also brings a lot of great cases on this, that if you essentially say, lose a car or something because of a traffic violation, that clearly, at the very least, that has to violate the excessive fines clause along the lines of the Gorsuch concurrence.
Yeah, and you've got Americans around this country who, I mean, are literally getting robbed on the side of the road by the government, taking their money if they have cash, you know, and or cash at the airport. And we had a case in Philly where the Institute of Justice represented the homeowners, where their grandson was outside dealing pot or something, and they wound up losing the house. They didn't even know the kid was doing it. So there's a lot of these examples of that across the country. So I do hope that, that is dealt with as well. But more than anything, I think we're all excited and optimistic about Chevron. Can you just give us a little insight into that case and when? It's already been heard, right?
That's right. It'll be heard in the next upcoming term. So sometime between October of this year and April of next year, that's the upcoming term. It's about whether the a fisheries agency could force small-time fishermen to pay for a government monitor to be on their boats to make sure they're not, you know, catching too many fish. The statute had nothing to say about this. It was completely silent. An agency just said, oh, we're going to fill a gap and say that it's allowed. We can force people to do this. And the petition to the Supreme Court explicitly said, we want you to take this case and reconsider whether Chevron should be overturned. And the Supreme Court said, we're going to take this case and we're going to limit it to that question. And so that's a really strong sign that the Supreme Court is taking very seriously the question about whether Chevron should be overturned entirely. And I think there are a lot of tea leaves suggesting that there are at least five, if not six, justices that are ready to overturn Chevron.
And then in layman's terms, what does that mean then if Chevron is overturned?
It essentially means more power to courts and less power to agencies to interpret the law. So the judicial power is vested in the courts of Article 3 in the Constitution. Chevron says that if it's a close case, if it could go either way, a court has to defer to the agency's legal judgment as long as it's within the bounds of reasonableness. So, you know, even if a court would go one direction, they have to go the opposite direction if that's what the agency thinks it is. So it essentially makes agencies part-time judges for interpreting statutes that apply to their own power. And you can see how they would have an incentive to always interpret it maximally to say, oh, yes, this gives us the maximum amount of power. So if Chevron's overturned, that's not going to happen anymore. Judges are going to be deciding more legal questions without a thumb on the scale of what the agency thinks is right.
Excellent. Well, we're hoping here. Thomas Berry, thank you so much for joining me today. Keep up the great work at the Cato Institute. We really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
All right. Well, speaking of water on your property, the good news is that the EPA can't regulate it anymore unless it's contiguous to an actual navigable body of water or something that is obviously water like a lake or a stream. But the bad news, though, is that if you have water on your property, it's probably costing you a lot of money and causing you a lot of damage. That's why you need to reach out to Garden State Earthworks. Here's the number. 856-848-4444. We've got more rain coming. This weekend might be a mess, actually, or maybe early next week. But wherever water is a problem on your property, you need to deal with it. Perhaps it's causing you problems with your swimming pool, your pool liner's floating, or it's causing you damage to your hardscaping, your landscaping, getting in your house, basements, crawl spaces. That causes mold and mildew, and you got mosquitoes breeding in your backyard. If you've got water swales, you need the professionals at Garden State Earthworks to deal with it. Don't trust a landscaping company. Trust the experts, the people that I used in my old home when we had a wet basement. They showed up, they said, we will drain this water away, guaranteed, and you'll never have another drop of water in that basement again. And they were right. 856-848-4444 or go to GardenStateEarthworks.com. They drain the water away once and for all, and when it's gone, it's gone. And you'll have peace of mind because water problems never, ever get better on their own. They always require somebody to help. And Garden State Earthworks is the best at what they do. 856-848-4444 or GardenStateEarthworks.com.
Baseball is back. Basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
The Cioli Show.
on your schedule from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT in the free Odyssey app.
You know, speaking of government and all the craziness that they do, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, the leader of the squad, may have said the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my entire life when she talked about all the people out there that just love all the things that government does for them. It really is amazing to think about the mind of a leftist like this. It really is. So she was talking about the debt ceiling. She was speaking on the floor of the House of Representatives, and she's yelling as usual. And she said this, and I only could think of what Ronald Reagan once said about the scariest words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Cut 19.
But they are accusing Democrats of saying we spend too much. For anyone that wants to entertain that thought, I ask you to think about the last time a person has said in this country that the government does too much for them, that their Social Security check was too high, that teachers are paid too much. When was the last time anyone has heard or seen that?
That's the mindset of a lefty, that the government does all these wonderful things for you and you should love it and you should give it a big hug all the time. It's so sweet and so special. That's really what they think. And then Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, well, she discussed the debt ceiling while speaking on the House floor and actually invoked God, which is amazing that she would actually even know who God is. But cut 18.
Grabian.
Oops, cut 18.
The Republicans continue to govern in a way that is clueless, callous, and with great contempt, and I would say godless, because faith without works is dead.
Interesting. Democrat Representative Pramila Jayapal, these are all members of the squad, of course. It's actually the media that's the problem in this country. It's the media. Wow, that's rich. That's rich from a lefty, isn't it? Cut 17.
But you're willing to tank it if it's not?
They are willing to tank it. They, no, sorry. That is exactly the problem, is when the media reports this as not their fault. And I'm just going to say, I know so many of you, I have so much respect for what you do, but let's tell the truth here. We are not tanking anything.
The media is the problem. It's just they're so mean to Joe Biden. You know how they report on Joe Biden? It's just so gosh darn mean, these people. I tell you, it's so sad. Now, Hakeem Jeffries, who is the leader of the Democrats, was asked the question as this battle goes on about whether or not they're going to raise the debt ceiling, have a compromise, do something. And there was no answer really as to why Democrats just didn't raise the debt ceiling themselves when they were in the majority, because they were in the majority. In fact, they had both chambers of Congress at one point. Cut 16.
Do you have regrets that your party did not raise the debt ceiling when it was in the majority?
It's not my understanding that the challenge was not addressing the debt ceiling because Democrats refused to do it. But it's my understanding that Republicans in the Senate were unwilling to discuss this issue last December, perhaps because they wanted to set up a hostage-taking situation.
Hostage-taking situation, which, by the way, was my Blondie cover band name in college. We are hostage-taking situation. And we were damn good, by the way. Really good. Now, the other question, of course, that everybody's asking today is, how did Governor Ron DeSantis do last night? What do you think? Give me your thoughts on that. Now, there's two aspects of this, right? There is the Twitter unveiling. There is the Twitter Spaces component of it. And then there is the substance of what he said. I don't think it was a good idea to do the Twitter Spaces last night. Now, call me old-fashioned. I'm a big political campaign rally guy. I love rallies. I do. I love the energy of them. I think they're great. I love a live crowd. That's why I'm excited for KMA tomorrow. You know, I love a live crowd. I love being in front of people. There's an energy in the room that is a different dynamic. And I would do every show in front of a live audience if I could. I mean it. I really would. There's a different dynamic to it, and it's a lot of fun. That's why tomorrow in KMA is going to be a blast. But I think one of the things about listening to the Twitter thing last night was it sounded, quite frankly, boring. Now, I understand that maybe, perhaps, that's the strategy to show everybody that this is going to be a mellow, more adult campaign or something like that. But I don't know. I think people still like the energy and the excitement and the enthusiasm. Elon Musk, smart guy, not exactly the most energetic and engaging guy. I think it's good to listen to him because of the accent and everything like that, but you know, and not exactly, you know, killing him at the improv. But and then DeSantis with him in that setting, I think toned him down unnecessarily. Where if he had been in a big crowd with lots of people cheering and screaming and balloons and the American flag and his wife on stage with him and everything else, I think he would have had a much different night. And that's what everybody would be talking about versus talking about this. He put his trust in the hands of Elon Musk and it didn't go well. And that's what everybody's talking about. They're actually debating the method by which he announced versus the things he said in his announcement, which in some ways is a commentary on where we are as a world and a society. Sure. But it still is relevant because inevitably your political enemies make an issue out of it. Trump was mocking it. Biden was mocking it. And all day, the media has been just teeing off on him. You know, the idiots on Morning Joe this morning were just mocking him and laughing at him and belittling him. It's not DeSantis' fault that that happened. It's Twitter's fault. It's Elon Musk's fault. But he's still the one that made the decision to do that. And so for that reason, his campaign tried to turn it into a positive yesterday. They came out and they said, we broke the internet. Let's see what we'll break next. And they actually put together a short little campaign video about that. Which is a great way to, you know, rapid respond, which is good. But do you really want to be in a position where the day after your announcement, everybody's talking about not what you said, but they're talking about the platform by which you made the announcement? Probably not. And that's why I think this ultimately was a mistake. Now, people disagree with that. Some people have said it's great that he did it that way because it shows the legacy corporate media that their time is up. True, except that he then just went on, he went on Fox News right after that. So he went, he did Twitter, and then he went right over to Fox News and he sat down with Trey Gowdy for an hour and chatted with him. In other words, the campaign is not exactly saying that from now on, we're not doing any traditional, conventional corporate media events where we just wanted to do something different to start. He made his decision. He's the candidate. Personally, if it were me, I would be furious at what happened with Twitter and the Twitter spaces. I would. And I don't think the whole argument about breaking the internet and there were so many people and everything, it's not even that. It's the format. People like to see their candidates. People like to see them and they like to hear from them at the same time. Now, does that mean that as a radio guy, I'm suggesting that perhaps that TV is more powerful than talk radio? Not at all. It's a different atmosphere. It's a much more intimate atmosphere. It's me and you talking together. We're having a conversation. You're listening one-on-one. But I'm not running for president. And we like to see our candidates. We like to hear from them. We like to see them. But this has been the big change ever since really the invention of the television. And presidential debates went from radio to TV. And radio and TV. But radio to television. People could see a candidate, look at his reactions, look at his face, his body language. This is something that they want. And it's no knock on radio, because obviously I'm in radio. We are going to stream the 5 o'clock hour live on YouTube, though, so we'll bring a little video component to it. And more people now are streaming radio shows using a camera on some platform or another. More and more now it's Twitter, like the Daily Wire, the Post Millennial. All their hosts are now doing all their shows on Twitter. Megyn Kelly does her podcast on Sirius XM. She videotapes, showing my age there. She records the whole thing, and it's shown on some video platform device. Joe Rogan does the same thing. I don't know if he pops in the old VHS tape, if he covers up the little hole with a piece of tape to record over something. Matt and Henry literally have no idea what I'm talking about right now. This is amazing. You guys have no idea, do you?
I don't know.
Less than zero.
Wow. There was a time in this country when people had something called a VCR. You guys ever heard of it?
I remember VCR.
Yeah.
I'm not that young.
Okay. So in order to tape, like literally a tape a show or tape a movie, you had to stick a VHS tape in there and you had to hit record. And if you wanted to record over it, you'd put a little piece of tape over the... There's kind of the same thing with cassette tapes. You guys ever heard of a cassette tape?
Yeah. That I don't... I mean, I know what a cassette tape is, but I don't have any familiarity with it.
Did you ever have a cassette? You never had one? Nothing like that?
I had the cassette tape with an aux cord attached to it. So what? If you had an older car, you with a cassette player, you put the cassette in and the wire sticks out, and that would be your aux cord.
See that?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. Well, you used to cover it up. You would take tape and put over the holes, and then you could record over it. That was the thing. So you could keep using the same VHS tape over and over again. I don't know what the purpose of that was. I guess to save you a few bucks, but that's why people did it. Anyway, the point is that more and more people are using a video element to things and not necessarily videotaping it, but they're streaming. I just think for DeSantis last night to be in a situation where, for many people, believe it or not, it might have been the first time they heard from him. I know that sounds crazy, but for a lot of people, they don't live and breathe politics like I do or you do. And last night may have been the first time, and they might have been intrigued. They might have heard a lot about him. They might have seen a lot of stories about him, but they may have never heard from him. And I think it would have been very beneficial for him to not only have the energy of a crowd, but also to be on camera to let people see him. I don't know why. I understand the point of Twitter Spaces, which is basically like radio for Twitter. And I get that. And I think it's great. I think the intimacy of it is fantastic. It's why I love talk radio. The intimacy of talk radio, there's nothing like it. You don't feel the level of connection and friendship to a TV personality the way you do to a talk show host on the radio. You don't. It's not the same. Nobody felt what they felt for Rush Limbaugh, for what they feel with people on TV. Even people that they love, like Tucker Carlson, they might love him, but that connection is not the same. When Rush died, it was people felt like they'd lost a family member or a friend, because that's how intimate that connection is. There's something a little bit different about TV in that respect. But for candidates, I think being good on television is a must. I think, let's face it, it's one of the things that's helped Donald Trump. Throughout his career, Donald Trump is a showman. He's great on camera. He knows how to use the camera for his benefit. He was the guy on The Apprentice all those years. And he knows how to use it to his benefit every time. It's an advantage that he has. So that's my overview of the event itself. Here's a little bit of a clip. DeSantis was on with Laura Ingraham last night on Fox News. And, or I should say David Sachs was on with Laura Ingraham on Fox News last night. He was the guy that was moderating it with Elon Musk. This is what he said about it and the technical difficulties that they had. Cut one.
The question on everyone's mind, including my daughters tonight, is what happened? I mean, you handled it so well, much better than I would have. But what happened at the top?
Well, what happened at the top, Laura, is just we had a million people simultaneously trying to get into a Twitter space, which is an online room. And, I mean, DeSantis just melted the servers. We had so much interest. I mean, I got to hand it to him. Normally it takes a Kardashian to do that. So we just had so much interest. It took about 15 minutes. We've never had that level of scale before on Twitter. I think the biggest room's been around 100,000. And so after about 15 minutes, we just moved the room to my account from Elon's account. And then it really worked perfectly. I think if your viewers want to go on Twitter, the recording is going viral right now. They're going to wonder what all the fuss is about, because once we got started, the audio was perfect. And I think the governor was totally unflappable. And I think one thing I learned about him from this is that once we did get started and we were, about 15, 20 minutes late, there was no hint of anger or irritation on his part. He was in a great mood. Like I said, cool and unflappable. Really, I think made a great impression of someone who doesn't get thrown off his game very easily.
I will say that's 100% true. And I was thinking about that too last night. I was thinking about DeSantis must inside be irking over this, but he didn't come across that way. He really didn't, which is good. And I'm glad he didn't, because I think people were waiting to see that. Is this guy going to be cranky now? Is he going to be nasty now over this? Or is he going to be cool with it? And he came on and he was just fine. So the question, of course, is now that that's over and you focus on his message and his substance, is he the guy who Republicans are going to embrace, or is it going to be Trump? I view this as a two-man race. I really do. I don't think that's ever going to change. It's a two-man race. I think DeSantis has a long way to go, but there are a lot of people in the Republican Party that obviously want to stop Donald Trump from becoming the nominee. They don't think he can win. They think that he's going to bring the party down with him, and they are determined to stop him. There's enough people like that that makes this a two-man race, because those people have decided it's smart to get behind one horse, and they need to if they're actually going to take him on. It's got to be a one-on-one fight. So the question is, based on DeSantis' answers yesterday, is he the guy? I'll give you some audio, and I want to hear your reaction to this. 855-839-1210 on Twitter, at Rich Zeoli, if you want to weigh in as well. So much to talk about, right? And we're live at the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey tomorrow. And this kicks off the official start, or unofficial start, to summer. And now is the time to get that body of yours into shape. Get it into the fat burning zone. So this summer, you could take your shirt off at the beach. You don't want to be that person in the pool wearing a shirt, or sitting there on the beach wearing a shirt because you're embarrassed. You want to be able to enjoy summer because you're going to be 20 to 40 pounds lighter with NJ Diet. 20 to 40 pounds lighter in only 40 days, contractually guaranteed. That's right, guaranteed weight loss with NJDiet.com. And it works because it's based on your DNA, your biochemistry. And there's no prepackaged foods, no shots, no hormones, none of that stuff, just real weight loss. So reach out to them today. Go to NJDiet.com for live online video consultations, or there's a center nearby you. Cherry Hill, King of Prussia, Newark, Delaware. Reach out today. 855-5NJ-DIET. 855-5NJ-DIET, and lose the weight for good. Summer is here, but it's not here yet. It'll be here soon. And by the time summer is midway rolling through 4th of July, you are going to be looking and feeling your best. Think about what that'll feel like in July and August, and then the fall. And then as everybody's bulking up for the winter, you'll still be looking your best, because with NJ Diet, you keep the weight off. NJDiet.com. Go there today.
Thanks for listening to the Zeoli Show podcast from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the Odyssey app.
All right, it is Thursday, which is basically Friday. And tomorrow, of course, we'll be live at the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey. So hope to see you there for our live show. It's going to be a lot of fun. Wow, there's a lot to get to. There's so much to talk about. It is a very, very busy week. I'll tell you, this week has flown by again. Again, it's flown by. So one of the things I wanted to mention, though, is so Donald Trump, obviously, I think the feds are coming for him. I've always told you they want him. They want him gone. They're not going to stop. There's a story today from National Review that an obstruction indictment may be imminent in Trump's Mar-a-Lago case. Andy McCarthy writing this, and he said, the case that was originally about the mishandling of classified information became about misleading a federal grand jury. And what Andy McCarthy's concern here is, and his concern of Ty Cobb, who's Trump's former White House lawyer, is that the government is going to charge him because it can't just be about having classified documents. Because if it was about classified documents, they'd have to charge Joe Biden. They'd have to charge Mike Pence. They'd have to charge everybody, because everybody had classified documents. But with Trump, it's going to be something more, because they won't ever stop. And I always told you, if the government wants to get you, well, the government's going to get you. Biden's got problems. Of course, the difference, though, is that the feds are not going after him. They should, as the whistleblowers have come forward and said, they should be going after Biden, Hunter Biden. They should be bringing it all to the table and finding out the direct connections with Joe Biden. No question about it. Biden's problem prompted a major overhaul at the Justice Department, which had been cruising toward a Trump Espionage Act indictment. Mishandling national defense information. That was what was in the Mar-a-Lago search warrant. But Trump had documents, and then Biden had documents. So all of a sudden, it became a thing of, well, if you're going to charge Trump, you know that Biden's going to get charged. If not now, then when he then at some point. So it had to be something else, right? All of a sudden, out of nowhere, magically, the Trump documents case became the Trump grand jury obstruction case. Just like that. Oh, couldn't be about documents anymore, and they still want to get him. So they're not going to stop. They're just going to pivot. That's what they're doing. There were lots of things that an indictment, lots of signs Andy McCarthy sees that an indictment could be imminent. The Wall Street Journal reports that special counsel Jack Smith has completed the investigative phase of his Mar-a-Lago inquiry and is at the point of deciding whether he will indict Trump. The former president's lawyers have dashed off a letter to Biden's attorney general, Merrick Garland, demanding a meeting, which suggests they believe Smith is poised to file charges. He may already have proposed a charging decision to Merrick Garland. That is worth pausing over. There was no reason for Garland to appoint a special counsel for Trump because there is no conflict of interest in the Biden Justice Department investigating Trump. The conflict lies in the Biden Justice Department's investigating of Hunter Biden and the Biden family. But Garland refuses to appoint a special counsel. Refuses. Isn't that something? Special counsel to investigate Trump and the classified documents. No special counsel to investigate Biden. And there's a big difference. There's no conflict of interest when it comes to Trump in this Justice Department. None. He didn't appoint Merrick Garland. He didn't appoint the head of the FBI, or he did appoint the head of the FBI, but he's got a 10-year term. It's irrelevant. There is a direct conflict of interest with the president of the United States and the investigation into his son, Hunter Biden. The reason why you have a special counsel, the reason why you have the special counsel statute, is so that you have someone who is a scrupulous, nonpartisan prosecutor who does not work under the direct purview of the Justice Department, so that that person can't be influenced by the president trying to influence the attorney general. That's why you have one. And if you can't think of a better reason than to make sure that Biden and the investigation into Hunter Biden is not tampered with, that there's not political favoritism, it's that. And we already know there's political favoritism. We know there is because we've heard the whistleblowers come forward and say it. The IRS and the FBI whistleblowers have all said there's favoritism going on here to protect Hunter Biden. Of course, that's why there needs to be a special counsel who can come in and say and make sure that there is no political interference being waged here. None whatsoever. So Garland appointed Smith out of a political calculation, Andy McCarthy writes, not to ward off a conflict of interest. He knew Trump, in seeking the presidency, would claim that Biden was weaponizing the Justice Department against the opposition. So he decided to have this independent person come out there, the special counsel, Jack Smith, come out there and say, I am not part of this Justice Department. But as often happens with those who engage in subterfuge, Garland was too clever by half. When it turned out that Biden was a serial classified information pilferer, the appointment of Jack Smith left Garland no choice, left him no choice but to appoint a special counsel to probe Biden's illegal document retention himself. But unlike Smith, who was given sweeping authority to investigate Trump over Mar-a-Lago and potential January 6th offenses, this special counsel looking into Biden's documents has a very narrow task, and that is literally only the documents. He is literally not authorized to look into the Biden family business. No authorization to look into Joe Biden's peddling of political influence for big bucks from corrupt anti-American regimes. Of course, Biden will never be charged with crimes related to classified documents. Justice Department guidance does not permit the indictment of a sitting president. But Garland will ultimately decide that no charges should be brought anyway. Nobody is ever going to think that he's going to charge the president of the United States with having classified documents. And there's so much ambiguity about whether or not a president can take them after they leave office, whether or not they declassified them, what the process is, the mechanism is. There's that case with Bill Clinton's sock drawer years ago where a D.C. Circuit Court judge basically said the president had the right to keep those documents at his house in his sock drawer. Thank God it wasn't his underwear drawer. You imagine what that scene must be like, that crime scene? So then all of a sudden, out of the realm of possibility, they came with this idea of obstruction of justice, that Trump fought the government all the way on turning in the documents. It's laughable is what it is. It is laughable that they're going down this road, but going down this road, they are. Their argument is going to be that Donald Trump did not cooperate with the government who was trying to get these documents back. Therefore, Donald Trump is guilty of engaging in obstruction of justice. You believe that? The most important document in the Mar-a-Lago case does not bear classified markings. It bears the raised seal of a federal grand jury subpoena. The Trump case is no longer about classified documents. It's about how Trump caused false information to be communicated to investigators and the grand jury, specifically through the sworn claim provided by his lawyers that after a diligent search, The approximately 38 documents they surrendered to the FBI that day were the only ones bearing classified markings left at Mar-a-Lago. So now they're saying that that's not true, and that Trump purposely lied when he said that he gave them all the documents. So now the Mar-a-Lago case has become now about lying about the documents and hiding the documents, not the content of the documents, which would hit too close to home for Joe Biden. That's the case. That's the case they're going to lay out against the former president. I think it's laughable. I think it's only going to help him again. I think it's going to be one more time that you see the government going after this guy, and people are going to say this is nonsense. Obstruction, really? He lied about the number of documents he gave back. So they're going to get him on the old you lied to the FBI thing. That's what they're going to get him on. The former president of the United States of America, the man who is the Republican frontrunner for the presidency. They're going to indict him over that? Seriously? That's what Andy McCarthy thinks. And he's probably not wrong, because this is a Justice Department that is hell-bent on getting this guy. Hell-bent. It doesn't make it right. In fact, it's not right. But they are hell-bent on getting him regardless. And I hope it doesn't happen, because it would be terrible for justice. He'll beat it, but it would be terrible for justice, and it'd be one more example of how the United States Department of Justice has become completely and utterly weaponized. We have a half hour of nonstop talk for you, courtesy of our friends at the Grand Hotel of Cape May, New Jersey, where we'll be tomorrow. Live show tomorrow, 3 to 7 p.m. Coming right back.
Rich Zeoli, weekday afternoons, 3 to 7. Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, and on the free Odyssey app. Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.